Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a podcast produced by KGNU in collaboration with the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran of KGNU, as always, my co-host Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And we're continuing our conversation with author John Krakauer, who really needs no introduction, but we've been talking to him about his classic Krakauer, Essays on Wilderness and Risk. Now, of course, John, you're most famous for, I think, your novels as well, really, as your magazine articles. But I want to talk about one of your books in particular, Into the Wild, because as we speak, it is the 25th anniversary of the publication of that book that still ripples into people's consciousness. People are still impacted by it in very tangible ways. And I know that you are impacted by this book, too. I mean, as we talked about in the radio show, how personal you take so many of these stories, and particularly when you're writing about very often somebody dying. And I know that you really related on a very personal level to Chris McCandless, and that's how you were able to, I think, get his family to talk to you back when it was a magazine article, because you said, I think I understand Christopher. So many people are saying he has mental illness, he was suicidal. That's not what was going on, because I see a lot of me in him. I mean, take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, my editor, Mark Bryant, had seen this very short article in the New York Times about, they called him the hiker, the missing hiker who turned up dead in an abandoned bus in the wilderness. It was a weird story, and they found a diary, and that was about it. And right away, it was fascinating, and then I started digging. And, you know, right away, Alaskans criticized him. Oh, he was an idiot, he didn't know anything, didn't even have an axe. And I thought a little differently, because he died, Chris McCandless, the subject of the book, died when he was 24. When I was 23, I also went to Alaska alone. I was living in Seattle at the time, and I hitchhiked to Southeast Alaska on a fishing boat and made my way to the mainland where a glacier came down to the sea, and skied up this glacier for 30 miles to this ice cap, the Stikine ice cap on the border with Canada and Alaska. And I spent a little over 3 weeks climbing a mountain, a very hard, very scary mountain called the Devil's Thumb by myself, by a new route. I survived by some skill, but a lot of luck. I had a number of close calls. And, you know, I knew I definitely was not suicidal. I came from a complicated family, as most are, and I was trying to, you know, no one cared that I climbed this mountain. I knew that a few climbers would, but no one else would. I did it for myself, to prove something to myself. And a lot of people can't relate. That's just stupid. But to me, it made perfect sense, and I pulled it off. And it didn't change my life, but that was a lesson too. It didn't stop me from wanting. But anyway, I thought I knew who this kid might be. And I was angry that people dismissed him without really knowing him. And when I approached the family, you know, there had been a fair amount of interest. People magazine had done an article right away. The cover of the book, the original cover, Into the Wild, that stark photo of the bus and the snow, that was taken by a People magazine photographer. And there was a lot of interest. The family had been bombarded by reporters wanting to write an article, not books, but articles. And, you know, I was just one more in line. So I approached them. I sent them Hiker Dreams, which includes a chapter about my climb of the Devil's Thumb, this mountain. And I said, look, read this. I think if you do, you might see that I'm different than all these other, you know, yellow journalists. I'm going to approach this differently. And that, because I was a climber and got done that Alaska trip, that's what, I sent it to their lawyer. Their lawyer was, you know, the bouncer. And he wrote me back and said, huh. And he had done a little climbing too, I think. But he said, yeah, the family was impressed by this. They'll talk to you. And that was my entree. And once I talked to them, and they showed me all the photos he'd taken and left behind, which were, that's the book right there. These hundreds of photos that trace his journey. It's gonna, hard to, you know, I helped the family a lot by figuring out where each photo was taken, because I retraced his journey pretty much everywhere he went over the next, you know, first I wrote an article for Outside, and I had to write that in like less than 2 months. So I couldn't do all the research I wanted, but I did a lot of research. Pretty much as soon as that article was published in January 93, I immediately decided I wanted to write a book, because there was so much more to write. And this is the only book I've enjoyed writing. It's short. It's only 65 or 70,000 words. And the research was so much fun. It was because I'd written the article. It was a viral hit, as it were, back in the days before there was viral internet or any internet, really. And they got a ton of letters, more letters than they'd ever gotten in the magazine's history. And a number of those letters, not a lot, but several, were from people who'd actually met him during his wandering around the West and Canada and Alaska. And so these people wrote to the magazine, and that the magazine forwarded the letters to me, and I was able to get sources that I didn't have when I wrote the first article. And those were fed. So I drove all over the West, you know, all over the place, and talked to these people, and that was really fun. I mean, and putting the pieces together was really fun. And figuring out what killed them wasn't fun, but I was on a mission, because I keep coming up with different hypotheses, different theories that were close but not quite right. And the Alaskans just had a field day. I was just considered a clown, you know, that I'd done this to get rich. I was romanticizing an idiot, I've taken so much shit from Alaskans, and that's fine. I get it. I never established residency, but I've lived in Alaska as a carpenter, as a commercial fisherman. I get Alaskans. I admire them. I have a lot of Alaskan friends who think McCandless is an idiot, and I'm an idiot, but that's all right. But I didn't think he was, and I was on a mission to prove that he died because he ate a plant that he believed was safe to eat. He had a book of edible plants, and the plant turned out to be poisonous. And it took me until 2013 to conclusively prove this, but I did. I had to teach myself organic chemistry and do, you know, hire laboratories and test seeds, and had to get my, to convince, I had this duel with this professor of chemistry at University of Alaska Fairbanks, who kept, you know, going public with Krakauer is so full of shit. You know, I've tested these seeds inside and out. They're not positive. I would eat them myself for dinner. And this guy and I had it going back and forth. And when I finally came up with the second or third theory that was almost correct, I thought it was at the time. I'd found, originally I thought he was killed by a poisonous amino acid, a lot of plants, or I'm sorry, a poisonous alkaloid. A lot of plants have powerful alkaloids. Caffeine is one, you know, there's a ton of them. It turns out I realized it wasn't an alkaloid, that it was an amino acid. And I came up and I determined the molecular weight was 176, and I found this amino acid that had really fascinating thing called ODAP that had been used by the Jews to, they'd experimented with, used by the Germans to kill Jews. They'd experimented with them. Long story. And this professor said, that's fine theory, but until you publish in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, fuck you. And I was like, okay, you know, you got a point. I'm going to do that. And he goes, good luck. You know, you went to Hampshire College. That's a hippie school. You know, you don't even know chemistry. So I got it published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal that what killed him, or what was a contributing factor to his death in the conservative language of scientific journals, was an amino acid called L-cannabinine. And it's what did it. You know, this book said this is edible. The roots of this are edible, and he'd been eating them for a long time. But when the roots became inedible in late summer, he started eating the seeds. And it turns out the seeds have this amino acid that if you're doing well, you're probably going to be okay, but he was such a meager diet, just barely scraping by, and these seeds pushed him over the edge. I mean, the book, you know, his journal, and this very sparse, cryptic journal, you know, near the end of his life, he'd written, you know, his alarming entry in the journal, extremely weak, fault of potato seeds, much trouble just to stand up. You know, he talks about day 100, made it, but near death. These entries are... He talks explicitly about the seeds. McCandless, why would he do that if he didn't know that the... And he had these photos of... He photographed whatever he ate, the animals he killed, the plants he gathered, and he had these big Ziploc bags full of these seeds from this plant that I identified. And man, that's pretty good evidence. But until I proved it... So anyway, that was in 2013 or 14 where I finally proved that. I even forget your question. I've been going on
too long. Well, you know, what interests me is the book has lived so long with you that you want to the book doesn't end with a publication of the book. And having talked to you these last few months, it seems like that's true of almost all your books. Life going on. You know, you have Into the Thin Air, and even in this essay collection, there's a small essay you wrote for The New Yorker in 2014, I believe, revisiting Everest. The Pat Tillman book, you know, Missoula. Maybe talk about how these books, not just Into the Wild, but some of the other ones, continue to live on for you, or how you're still connected to these stories.
Well, you know, this is related. You asked me why these people talk to me, and it's because I have empathy and I care about them, and it's genuine. And so you dig into people's tragedies and their lives, and man, you develop a relationship, or you can't even do it. It's like it's you. I mean, I'm really close with Corinne McCandless, his sister. Still, I talk to her on the phone all the time. I'm close with Marie Tillman, the widow of Pat Tillman. I could go on and on. So yeah, these don't leave. The people I meet are the women in Missoula. I'm still involved with all of them. You know, or not all of them, but many of them. And so, I mean, that's why I'm not writing any more books. I can't do it anymore. I mean, it's too hard on me. It's too hard on my wife. It's just like, you know, I'm OCD, but I'm 66. I'm about to be 67. I just can't. I'd rather spend whatever good years I've left not in my basement obsessively rewriting sentences, you know. But you're right. The books don't go away, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the relationships I've established. The books mean something to me. I still probably unwisely defend them. You know, when someone writes another book saying my book's full of shit, I'll you know, in this day and age of digital publishing, I'll tell my publisher, stand by, I'm going to have a new addendum, you know, to Into Thin Air or whatever. And I do that at my publisher, like, oh my God, you know, but they do it.
Well, I stumbled across a letter to the editor you had fairly recently in The New Yorker. And I thought that was interesting, because even in that letter to the editor, there was a lot of passion. And it was about the guys who got to, I guess, the South Pole, I think, unaided. And you were taking up, what does the word unaided mean, or unassisted, right, or whatever the word was. And I thought that was interesting. So you might not be writing books, but you're still very plugged in and looking at what's going on.
Oh, yeah. You know, I still write stuff. I'm an activist. I'm involved in a number of nonprofits, even, you know, stuff I've started myself. So I still care and I still write, and I'm not exactly low-key, as you can tell. Just by my mom saying I have the Norwegian temperament. You can imagine what my siblings are like, you know, I mean, like, wow. But yeah, so like this guy who said he'd made the first unassisted crossing of Antarctica, you know, from one side to the South Pole to the other, well, several years before, many years before, that guy started, you know, in Antarctica, it's got these huge ice sheets for hundreds of miles that extend from land out into there's ocean under there somewhere, but you'd never know it. The real edge of the continent is the edge of the ice sheet. This guy had gone to where he calculated the ice sheet met the land, saving himself hundreds of miles, and then claimed on each end to have done that. A Norwegian had done it unassisted, twice a distance, 20 years earlier or something. And so it pissed me off that this guy not only did that, but when he got to the South Pole, he didn't say anything about this. There's a regular snow machine route. A huge snowcats have a ice road from the coast to the South Pole to resupply the South Pole. And these are massive snowcats, as big as this room, because there's huge crevasses, you know, hundreds of feet deep that they've got to be able to span. So, and they plow out. It's basically, you know, better than the road you're going to take this afternoon over Berthoud Pass. You know, it's ice, but it's solid, and it's marked every couple hundred yards with stakes. This guy was following that road for the second half of his trip, didn't mention it. He was very careful when he take photos that he'd get off the beaten snow machine track, and he didn't show any of those flags that are every couple hundred yards. And that pissed me off. That's bullshit. That's lying, you know? And so it's stuff like that. I mean, I care about stuff like, I care about the truth. You know, I get offended when writers make shit up. I get offended when our president makes shit up. I get offended when other athletes, because I have a lot of friends who do Arctic exploration, and they had done this stuff, they weren't tooting their own, they, you know, he went on Joe Rogan and wrote this bullshit book that that he sort of made become a fake bestseller. That stuff offends me. So
made a great letter.
Well, thank you.
Well, if you're not writing books, you know, where can people see future writings? Watch the letters to the editor section, obviously. I mean, what about blogging or shorter form?
I have an Instagram account. That's pretty short. Easy to read. I mean, you know, I notice people who follow my Instagram account, their attention span's about like a tiny gerbil. It's about 15 seconds back, so you can't write much. But I have an editor at the New York Times opinion page, the op-ed page, who regularly asks me to write stuff, and sometimes I agree to do it. I recently wrote an op-ed that I really care about, co-wrote with another Boulderite, a retired math professor at CU named Bill Briggs. He and I wrote an op-ed about a massacre in Louisiana in 1873 that was one of the, that ended up, unknown number of ex-slaves, recently freed slaves, were killed by white supremacists, and they came into this town and slaughtered them. And there was a criminal investigation and a prosecution and a trial, and everyone got off, and it went to the Supreme Court. And that Supreme Court decision ended up being one of the, in my opinion, and good evidence, being one of the major factors in ending Reconstruction and leading to the next 100 years of suppression of the black vote and Jim Crow. And the name of the massacre is called the Colfax Massacre. And Bill Briggs and I, the name of the article in the New York Times op-ed, I can't remember what it was called, something about the Colfax Massacre. If you Google it, if you go to my Instagram page and click on my profile, the little thing at the top, I list a bunch of articles that I've written that are posted on Medium or elsewhere. So yeah, if you want to read my stuff, go to my Instagram page, click on the profile. Instagram users know what that means. I didn't know what it means. Click on profile. What profile? What's that? I'm an old guy.
Is that the deadliest massacre? I feel like...
It's one of them. I mean, there was...
I feel like there might be a new book coming out on that.
There was a really good book that was our source, published a long time ago, called The Day Freedom Died.
Oh, yeah. I just read about that, and The Nation had an article about different white, you know, the history of white supremacism, and I think they quoted that book, because I had not heard of that massacre.
No one has, and it really was probably the greatest, or maybe the second greatest, mass murder in American history up until the time Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. So it's a major thing. It's a great book. So if you read this op-ed, there's a link to the book. I always would like to plug the book, if you know, the author deserves to have his book read. It's a really well written, really, it opened my eyes about Reconstruction. You know, growing up in Corvallis, Oregon, I wasn't a great student. I was a lousy student, but maybe that's part of the problem. That I always, you know, the Civil War, the good guys won, black people are, slavery's over, everything's great for black people. You know, what horseshit? That's just, why didn't I know that until I was in my 60s, how we really lost the Civil War. We won briefly, but then the South, Southern white supremacists in the South, you know, ended Reconstruction, and basically they won the Civil War.
Did it make your blood boil? It made my blood boil to see many things, but to see the Confederate flag in the Capitol a couple weeks ago or last week.
Oh, that was so chilling. I mean, it's I got a lot of letters from that op-ed from people about, just people complaining about how black people have all the advantages now. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, do you know what it means to see that? Can you imagine what a black person, what it must mean to them to see the Confederate flag being carried to the U.S. Capitol? I mean, people need to educate. I needed to educate myself. I was not as bad as anyone, but I was ignorant about the sort of the depth of the injustices of Jim Crow, it's astonishing to me that the Voting Rights Act of the 60s was overturned by John Roberts and his Supreme Court just in 2013.
Right after Congress had renewed it almost unanimously.
I know, and that is astonishing. I mean, it's going to be interesting times for as long as this. I'm really I'm glad I'm old and I'm not going to be around in 30 years, you know, and or 20 years. But I have faith in young people. I mean, they're motivated. I get it. I mean, they're so angry at our generation for climate, if nothing else. I mean, we're leaving them this mess on so many levels. That's just unconscionable to me.
That idea around the climate crisis, because I think that's such a hallmark now of writing about wilderness and open spaces. Now, you were, you know, writing about this back in the early 80s and 90s. If you were writing about some of that stuff that you wrote about then and doing it now, well, first of all, those landscapes would be totally different. But it seems like you can't write about that without, you know, unless you do it through the prism of the climate crisis.
Oh, yeah, I think it's imperative that you bring that into the discussion. I mean, you know, the first person I remember about writing about climate change really well is Bill McKibben, who's
still doing it.
Still doing it. I mean, more power to him. He's great. And he was, he was sort of one of the people I look up to. He was doing this before I was. And he's probably younger than me, but I think he started younger. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if I was starting another, there's certainly plenty to write about. I mean, we need more investigative journalists, just long form journalists, people who can engage readers and get them to read more than, you know, a 15-second Instagram post. That's the skill we need to develop among writers. I think it's much more challenging. The attention span of everyone, myself included, seems to be getting shorter and shorter because of, you know, the internet world we live in now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the market is so much tougher, as you talked about in the other interview. I mean, you said you were making $10,000 to $15,000 a year. I think a lot of long-form freelancers, unless they're really, really successful, they're maybe making $10,000 to $15,000 a year now. You know, when that's worth that much less. I mean, so much is on the internet, which is so badly paid. I look at our magazine rack downstairs. It's about 1/4 of the size it was when I started back in 1992. There's just not too many paying outlets, and it makes me fear for our public discussion. Where are these long-form journalists going to come from? Do you ever mentor younger people? Do you have?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And I've got plans in the work for doing more of that on a more organized basis. I think it's critically important. And there's the challenges are many, not just getting young writers paid, but figuring out ways to sort of compete effectively with the attention of people who are getting their knowledge from memes, you know, on TikTok or Instagram and Facebook. I mean, it's, and even, you know, the need to, we're just figuring out, you know, the dangers of Facebook. I mean, Facebook is one of the great evils of the modern world, I am convinced. And I don't even, you know, someone needs to write the definitive book about that. And I'm sure people are working on it because there's been some great writing about that. But man, our world is different. I mean, there was a great op-ed last week or a few days ago in the New York Times wondering if it's time to reconsider the First Amendment. I mean, how is the First Amendment now doing more damage to democracy? And I'm the biggest First Amendment fan you'll find. But, you know, social media is turning that on its head. So now social media is arguably destroying democracy. I mean, it came this close not very many days ago. And so this argument, and it's not decided, is, wow, do we need to reconsider the First Amendment to be able to do something about, you know, these voices on social media that are out, you know, they have no conscience, that are out to destroy our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, there's also a big misunderstanding about what the First Amendment actually protects and doesn't protect. And I think people will claim First Amendment rights when they don't even have them. I mean, humorously, Senator Josh Hawley got his book canceled last week by Simon & Schuster, and he claimed he was going to see him in court for First Amendment violation. Well, Simon & Schuster is not the government, so there actually is no First Amendment violation. But you see things like that all the time. And so I think that we have to be aware with social media, too, that maybe there are some ways, there are, you know, how much is really protected and how much isn't, and what are the possibilities? Because it does seem like that First Amendment ends up being a blanket to protect everything. And it's not really that.
Yeah, no, I know. It's really complicated about, you have Facebook, which owns Instagram, and Google have tremendous power they have so much power over what the world, the information the world sees, and their algorithms for YouTube and their algorithms for sharing Facebook posts. So it's not the government anymore that we have to worry about. I mean, I agree that Facebook and Google and Twitter, they don't have any First Amendment obligation. They can censor whoever they want. I mean, when Into the Wild was, my first contract for Into the Wild was canceled. My book was killed. It came this close to not getting republished. I didn't think, shit, my First Amendment rights have been violated. I thought, well, publishers do that. I mean, Facebook is a publisher. I mean, they don't want to be called that. Twitter doesn't want anything, but they are. They publish information. They've destroyed our newspapers. They get all the ad revenue. And now they're claiming some sort of, that they don't have any responsibility for. We just put it out there, it's infuriating.
Well, John Krakauer has been our guest after hours at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Follow him on Instagram for future writings. Thanks, John, for being with us.
Sure. If you find me on Instagram, my Instagram name is Krakauer Not Writing. One word.
Really?
That's funny. That's it.
Krakauer, not writing. Well, I'm glad you wrote something that we were able to talk so much about everything you've written today. Krakauer Not Writing on Instagram. Thank you, John, for being with us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, for KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore.
Thank you, Maeve.